So, Michael,
So,
it's a
Zoe,
long
great to see you.
time. I know it's a
Lovely.
long time. I remember first meeting you when you ran the London Herbal Students Group,
That's right.
and you invited me to visit.
Yeah,
And
I
I
remember that.
remember seeing you then, and I had this image that you and I would be the last herbalist standing.
Well, I'm not standing very well anymore. I need a stick to stand since my stroke, unfortunately.
Well,
But I'm still kicking.
I've given my working life to this strange profession, but and I saw immediately someone who was going to do the same, and you did, didn't you? I mean, you
I
really
did.
put everything into it. So that was late 70s.
Yeah.
So
No
40,
regrets, I have to say.
45 years ago, you
Yeah.
and I have been hanging out. So this is a chance to just, remember some of the things, you remember what we inherited when we arrived on the herbal scene, what we saw, the transformation through the 80s and the 90s, the battles we fought.
Yes, gosh, it's a catalogue, actually. I was writing it up the other day, and when I got to page 19, I thought, this is turning into a small book,
Well, you ought
to my
to.
horror.
You ought to write it,
I
publish it. Yeah.
think some of it's unwritable,
Well,
actually.
a good
But
you were an editor once, so you should know how to use the purple or green pen.
well, I think that. When I think about it now, I hear the refrain constantly from the news and other places about how we're so short of doctors. And the patients that I see come in and tell me that story almost every day. Somebody comes in and says, I couldn't get to see a doctor. Somebody came in last week and said they've finally got a date for this surgery that they needed, and the date was over a year away. And I thought, this is sort of Alice through the Looking Glass. It really is. It's extraordinary. Alice in Wonderland territory. It's unbelievable. And one of the solutions for it would be, in my opinion, using what already exists, which is a huge body of knowledge and enthusiasm and interest from the herbal sector, with some very clever and bright people who put their lives into helping other people using plant medicines. And I think it's a tremendous shame that the initiatives that we took over the 80s and the 90s and the thousands didn't actually bear fruit and find a regulatory framework that allowed herbal practitioners to work in this country. We've got a big problem with antibiotics, but we've got a solution potentially for doctors, nurses, and others working in the sector using plant medicines, of course, which you and I know so well, Simon. But of course, the research is the big issue, and all the research money is understandably going into conventional channels, and getting research money for herbal medicine is extremely difficult.
As we always knew,
Yeah. So proving that this stuff works is the key thing. The second thing is making it safe, and that actually was a driver that started this whole thing off, because around 2000 there was a horrific accident, series of accidents, herbal accidents that took place in Brussels, which, when we actually got to meet the politicians who were in charge of the health service here, they had absolutely no idea about. They looked flabbergasted when they were informed that this had already happened. And the incident I'm talking about is that a group of medical doctors who set up very, very expensive treatments in Brussels for the rich in Brussels who wanted to lose weight. And they made a capsule which was a pretty extraordinary mixture of a Chinese herb in powdered form, which was called mutong in Chinese. And they also put it with, I think, belladonna, deadly nightshade, that is. and some a drug that was used conventionally for
diuretic, wasn't it?
As a diuretic, yes.
Yeah.
Which actually had some reputation for damaging the kidneys.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of other items in there which weren't very nice and probably nobody would want to take in their right minds. And they mixed them all up together and put them in these capsules and started selling them to these ladies that came into their clinic who were charged very large sums of money. Unfortunately, the herb they got, they looked up a diuretic herb in a Chinese Materia Medica, and they bought in from Taiwan in powdered form, this herb, Aristolochia manchuriensis, was its full Latin name. And they didn't test it and they knew nothing about it. They didn't actually do any safety checks. They just put the herb.
They thought it was Stephania, didn't they?
Yeah, they thought it was Stephania,
yeah.
Which is a completely different herb,
yeah,
with the same Chinese name. Yeah. That was the trouble, was that it got mixed up because the name was the same.
Yeah.
And instead of getting to Stephania, they got the Aristolochia, but they didn't realise they got that.
Yeah.
And it also wasn't realised at that stage that Aristolochia was quite potently nephrotoxic.
Yes.
And so these poor women finished up months later with severe kidney damage, and many of them developing cancer later, some of them having to have kidney transplants.
Yes.
And of course, that this led to an international outcry, because Chinese medicine is ubiquitous and was in all European countries. And it was discovered that the Chinese supply of Stephania, the herb that the doctors had wanted to get, which is called actually in Chinese Fangji, but has also Mutong as well, was mixed up with it. That the whole supply line was all mixed together, and that nobody could guarantee that Stephania wasn't being contaminated with Aristolochia, and that's what happened. And it caused a convulsion in the what was then the MCA, the Medicines Control Agency at that stage, now called the MHRA, the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency. And at that stage, as it happened, due to other events that we might talk about, I went to the Department of Health to see if they were interested in regulating herbal medicine. And I found I was pushing at a very open door. They welcomed me with open arms and said, yes, we need to do this, because they'd seen what was going on. And frankly, they were facing a nightmare. I remember somebody very senior in the MHRA saying that had what happened in Brussels occurred in London, she might have found herself throwing herself out of the window. And I don't think she was joking, actually, of a very high building in which the MHRA were housed at the time in Vauxhall. And fortunately for her, it didn't happen here. Although there was at least one famous case that finished up at the Old Bailey of somebody who'd been given Chinese herbal pills that weren't properly made or identified, and no safety checks were run, and it had Aristolochia, and the person concerned lost her kidneys as well. Poor woman, she didn't deserve that. And so there were cases in the UK, and there were cases across Europe, and there was a general outcry, and it gave rise to a lot of publicity, bad publicity for herbal medicine, bad publicity for Chinese medicine, and really a kick in the pants for the legislators, who needed to start looking at making sure that there was some kind of quality assurance in place when people were using herbal medicines as teas or for medicines.
And that's, of course, where the House of Lords report also
came. That's where you come from.
Yeah. where we that was another open door, because they agreed fairly clearly that of all the complementary therapies out there, two, acupuncture and herbal medicine, were ripe for formal regulation and registration at the state level. We all thought it was all systems go, didn't we?
And it was, because at the very beginning of the noughties, the Department of Health set up this committee, or two committees, one to look at the regulation of acupuncture and another one to look at the regulation of herbal medicine and herbal medicine practitioners. And the one for herbal medicine and practitioners was chaired by a wonderful guy called Michael Patillo, who is a professor, I think, in biology at Robert Gordon University in Scotland. And he did tremendous work. Unfortunately, our history is littered with people who didn't quite make it, and he got kidney cancer and died very sadly during the course of all the work we were doing over the 20 years.
But the work that he and you did was really impressive, because we had white papers. Well, we had certainly consultation papers from the Department of Health. We went through the rounds, if not once, three times, with the process that would have led up to this regulation. And it was an amazing effort. The paperwork that was generated was really impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah. The result of that work, the initial work that took place with this committee that I mentioned, or the two committees, was that the Department of Health put out a consultation paper, public consultation, which involved the public responding to a huge number of questions about whether they wanted regulation. And the net result of that was they had something like a 98% vote in favour, public vote in favour of regulation. And so the Department of Health became even more determined. I can remember a senior civil servant saying to me, "Michael, you do realise this is definitely going to happen.
Yes.
All the politicians behind it, everybody's behind it." Well, it didn't happen. And that's a big question. Why not?
Well, we had at least one Secretary of State saying it was going to happen in the House of Commons.
2011, yes. He said he made...
This was Andrew Lansley.
Andrew Lansley, yes, made an announcement that herbal regulation was definitely going to happen. And it was a written statement, so it was on the record straight away. And it was a moment of rejoicing for us all.
I remember it well.
Yes, and it leaves me with a bitter taste now, all these years later, to think that it came to nothing. And one of the reasons why it came to nothing is the events that were going on elsewhere, which caused a convulsion in the whole regulation of the medicine sector. There was the dreadful murders by a British GP of his patients.
Yes.
We're talking about Dr. Shipman,
yes,
here, the dreaded Dr. Shipman. But that led to the most understandable need to overhaul and look at the whole of medical regulation.
Yes.
And the herbal process got caught up in that.
Yes, it did.
And it was decided by the powers that be, exactly why I'm not sure, because we had done the work, that the work would need to be done again. So, lo and behold, Michael Patillo, the previous chair of the working party, was put in charge of another committee, and we were all allocated to the committee, and we found ourselves trailing backwards and forwards on a regular basis to the Department of Health to do the same work that we'd already done, or largely done, but we had to do more of it to convince the authorities this was necessary. And guess what? At the end of that, it led to, I mean, it's funny when I talk about it like this, sounds like a joke, but it led to another public consultation. And these things cost a hell of a lot of money. God knows how much the public exchequer paid out on all this. So there was a public consultation again, and believe it or not, the uptake, the wish for regulation by the respondees was again in the very high 90s, in the 90%, 98% mark, when it came to analysing the responses. And these were published about 2008 or 2009, and it was decided that we would all go ahead. And so a further committee was set up to try to move forward so that we could actually get regulation. And Andrew Lansley's comments came in 2011 at a moment when European legislation on herbal medicine was changing. And that was another factor in all of this, is that the legislation that governed herbal medicine that had been there since the 1968 Medicines Act was published, was being altered by European legislation, mainly the European Directive on Traditional Herbal Medicines, the THMPD as it's known. And this directive would have taken out of the Medicines Act Section 12.2. I'm sorry to sound so technical, but Section 12.2, under which a whole lot range of herbs were sold over the counter without a need for a full medicines license. Just so we get this sorted, the medicines license question has always dogged herbs, insofar as herbs grow in the fields and the woods of our land, and they can't, thank God, be patented by anybody. So even if a drug company discovered that, for example, rosemary was good for Alzheimer's, they wouldn't be able to patent rosemary. They wouldn't be able to say, we've got the rights to rosemary, nobody else has. So the money that would have to be spent on developing medicine from these herbal medicines and marketing it wouldn't be available. And the general economic principles of drug manufacture and development don't really work when it comes to herbs.
15 or 20 years of protection.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, so we've always had that challenge, haven't we, that we're using plants that people use themselves, they're using remedies that people use themselves, and we're looking to find at least a group of people who could be seen as experts in that field, who could advise in complex conditions, who could work with other health professionals. And that was what we thought we were getting with this statutory process, that we could be seen as partners or people who worked in healthcare teams on an equal footing, providing some of that expertise. That was the dream I think we all had, that, you know, we could get our place and could start promoting the quality of these remedies without that pharmaceutical principle.
And I think, looking back, I recognize that I was to some degree naive in considering that herbal medicine would be accepted into the medical scene in the UK, that the powers that be that oversee medicine would happily welcome us in. So actually the reverse was the case, that there was definitely a move to try and prevent herbal medicine from putting its legs under the table. And herbal medicine itself didn't help, because there was a lot of internecine fighting amongst the herbalists, which really didn't help. They were very, very nervous about regulation.
Yeah.
They thought it would mean the end of herbal medicine,
which
I think wouldn't have been the case. So we were never able to offer a service, which I believe to this day we still can offer, and we should offer to the public, to the country.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, many doctors would like to use herbal medicines as well. And why shouldn't we train them in that?
Yeah, and it I mean, wouldn't so, be... so many of the conditions that that a challenging conventional medicine, the chronic inflammatory, the degenerative conditions, the ones that are not medically easily diagnosed, they all fit very neatly into the work that we do as practitioners. Absolutely. And, you know, all we need to do is have that recognized, systematized to some extent, but recognized as an option.
We've got a late spring here at the moment, and the sun has suddenly emerged, and here in Gloucestershire, where we are speaking from right now, all the hedgerows are absolutely laden with May blossom, yes. Hawthorn. Now past the cloud till May be out. Well, it's out with a vengeance.
Yes.
And that hawthorn is the most wonderful drug for helping the coronary circulation.
And
the arteries, the vascular circuit
in general.
In general. And that there is research for.
Yes.
And actually, I believe there was a paper published in the BMJ in the 1950s extolling the virtue of hawthorn tincture. So,
and there's mountains of it.
There is. And why aren't we using it?
Well, I remember I was actually consulted by a couple of pharmaceutical companies way back in the 80s. Looking because they wanted a new digoxin or whatever, and they'd picked on hawthorn, and they were hoping that I would help them to find the active principle. And you know as well as I do that there's at least two categories of constituents within hawthorn that balance each other out. One is bradycardic and one is vasodilatory, and you need the two together to bring about the magic of that plant. So, and that, as you say, the pharmaceutical companies walked away because they couldn't see how they could package that complexity. And that there is that opportunity. We keep seeing that there needs to be approached in a different way. We can't just treat it as a patentable pharmaceutics. As they do in Germany, but they package them up in medicinal form, extract them to a bit, but we don't even have that option very widely. The traditional herbal registrations apply, but hardly anyone knows about them. They're not well promoted. And so we come back to the point that these wonderful remedies are neglected.
Absolutely. Not by me, anyway.
No, we still punch away with them. Yeah.
Oh, no, this is a really splendid time of year for herb collection. And as you say, Simon, the hedgerows are packed with pharmaceuticals ready and willing to be used, and they grow so easily.
Yeah. Well, I often tell the story of Emily, my goat, who I learned all the herbs I needed from, because when I was way, way back running a small holding, Emily used to browse the Cornish hedges. And later I discovered that she was actually browsing a materia medica that we use in practice. So this is something that goes way, way back into the roots of the world. And, you know, we talked about a campaign that didn't come to fruition, but I'm also reminded of one that did, because you remember in 1994 when there was the first harmonization of European and English law.
Gosh, don't talk about that.
I think I lost a year of my life, and that campaign, you must have done the same. When at the end of it, we had John Major calling for the head of the MCAs on a plate, and we had people chaining themselves to railings. And that was one campaign that we actually did see change.
I've got a complete set of all the publicity that gave rise to. In one of my cupboards, and the paper of that stands about 3 or 4 feet high. It's quite extraordinary reading your way through it, and it's a wonderful cartoon in the middle of it, which I remember because Middlesex University had just started the very first herbal course,
which you started on a train.
Yes, I helped. Yeah, that's right. It's another lovely story. But anyway, I was actually then president of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists, and we decided that we wanted to find a university that wanted to do herbal medicine, but we couldn't. And I was coming back from London on the first Great Western, as it's called, and And this lady, the train was unbelievably crowded. This lady was finding her way up the passageway, and she fell over somebody's legs and fell in, literally into my lap, dropped her books into my lap. And I collected her books and realized that they were on medicine. And she sat down because there was actually room for her to sit while she gathered herself. And we went and had a gin and tonic in the drink bar, I remember. And she told me that she was very interested in herbal medicine. And she talked to the vice chancellor of Middlesex University, which she did. And from that came the first university course in herbal medicine, which had just been published 1990, just been launched in 1994, yeah.
when all this happened,
yeah. All this problem with herbs, which were threatened by European legislation. We'd always believed that European laws would never touch herbal medicine, but unfortunately that turned out not to be the case. But the introduction of the main European medicines legislation, 2001-83 EC. There you are. I turned into some kind of ghastly lawyer. They made it impossible for the Section 12 and 56, under which we practice, of the Medicines Act to continue. And the MCA told us that once that new legislation, the European legislation, was adopted by the UK on the 1st of January 1995, there would be effectively no more herbal medicine because it would be illegal. So we started publicising this, and the newspapers ran with it. And as I was just saying, there was a cartoon which showed some rather hairy looking students studying at a lecture room in presumably Middlesex University. And the person was saying, "Today we are doing St. John's wort because you will need this for depression when you qualify," presumably because you'd spend 3 years qualifying in something that would be illegal when you got there. It was quite extraordinary. Anyway, as Simon said, John Major's Secretary of State for Health, Virginia Bottomley, finally got it sorted out. They put a piece of legal sticking plaster over the whole thing, saying herbs were not industrially produced, they were traditionally produced, yes, which of course was a bit of nonsense.
The weasel words, yeah.
But actually, industrially,
the Secretary of State had crashed a meeting at the MCA.
Industrially produced was the part of the wording of the primary legislation that was going to operate against us.
Yeah.
So if they could show it wasn't operative, then we were still allowed to continue to exist, which we did after the 1st of January 1995. It's an eon ago now, but
it was one of the spurs for the MCA at that time to actually look to secondary regulation, because they didn't want to go into that mess again. So they thought that the one way to do it was to lift the herbal practitioner.
No, they put two or three really good civil servants, one called Richard Woodfield, who's a lovely, lovely man, who is very clever and really helped actually to get the whole thing sorted out, and worked with us on the committees that we were on. But unfortunately, he's no longer at the MHRA.
Yes.
And herbal medicine has lost a good friend and help in the civil service, which we need, actually.
Well, we're doing this well in the context of the College of Medicine, and we ought to acknowledge the help that Michael
absolutely
gave us throughout. From
Michael's been absolutely wonderful in standing strong when everything else seemed to be falling apart, and the college has been there to work on and develop and preserve the best of complementary medicine.
Yeah. And that's taking on new initiatives now under Michael's steering, with integrating again some of the complementary practitioners again. And we're a long way off from where we once were in hoping that herbal medicine could lift itself.
I think we've been blessed with having a lot of help. The then Prince of Wales was very helpful with his Prince of Wales Foundation for Integrated Health, gave grants to the herbal medicine community to run an office so that we could actually do all the paperwork that the government wanted us to do. But 20, 25 years of work must not be allowed to just disappear. We must keep it going, actually.
Well, I'm glad you've got all the collection, because one of the things we can usefully do is to have that as a reference point.
Yes, I put a collection together.
Yes.
So that if anybody wants to look up anything, they can find it.
Yes. No, thank you, Michael. And, you know, I want to take this opportunity to really express my appreciation for that huge amount of work you do. There was a couple of decades when we thought, you know, if Michael hadn't been there, nothing would have happened. You were sort of carrying this very much as a mission, and you know, it was really awe-inspiring. I was totally impressed.
Well, I think I was very fortunate to find something which inspired me, and I think, Simon, having colleagues such as you, who inspired me in herbal medicine, and to see the number of people that I've seen really benefit from herbal medicine, it makes my heart ache to think that it isn't generally available.
Yes.
And I'm just as passionate now as I was in the 70s when I started.
Yes, ditto.
I really am.
Well, we're two old soldiers still battling.
Yeah.
Yes, warriors, if not warriors.
Warriors.
Worrying warriors, yes. But out of that, we did it.
Yeah, and thank you, Michael. And thank you, the College of Medicine. I'm so happy to have you as supporters. What has gone on? Thank you.
We will stop recording.
Is that okay, Simon?